Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a new twist in the emerging Matt Gaetz scandal involving a former Air Force intelligence officer and a Florida real estate scammer who apparently tried to blackmail Matt Gaetz' wealthy father to put up money to rescue a former FBI agent held in Iran since March of 2007 who is presumed dead, in exchange for preventing Matt Gaetz' sex trafficking scandal from going public, which it now has. Jeff Stein, the editor and founder of Spy Talk and a veteran national security reporter previously with Newsweek and The Washington Post, joins us to discuss his latest article at Spy Talk, Gaetz's Extortion Figures Levinson Obsession. We'll discuss Jeff Stein's interaction with Bob Kent, the former Air Force intelligence officer who had proposed to Gaetz's father the wacky scheme to free someone believed to be dead in exchange for making his son the hero of Operation Homecoming, with the promise Matt would be given credit for bringing Levinson home, in exchange for which Kent would spike Don Gaetz's son's sex trafficking story. Then we'll look into the convictions of prominent pro-democracy activists today in Hong Kong, with the billionaire publisher Jimmy Lai facing the prospects of life in prison for sedition under China's new national security law. Michael Davis, a professor emeritus of law at the University of Hong Kong, whose latest book is Making Hong Kong China, The Rollback of Human Rights and the Rule of Law, joins us to discuss the suppression of democracy in Hong Kong and how it will impact Taiwan as Xi Jinping tears up the One Nation, Two Systems model. Then finally, we'll speak with Jason Morgan Ward, a professor of history at Emory University, where he teaches modern United States history and is the author of Defending White Democracy, The Making of a Segregationist Movement and the Remaking of Racial Politics, and Hanging Bridge, Racial Violence and America's Civil Rights Century. He joins us to discuss his article at the New York Times, Georgia's Voter Law is Called Jim Crow 2.0 for a Reason. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now, Jeff Stein, the editor and founder of Spy Talk and a deputy foreign news editor at United Press International, a veteran national security reporter previously with Newsweek and The Washington Post. He specializes in U.S. intelligence, defense, and foreign policy, and is the author of A Murder in Wartime, the untold spy story that changed the course of the Vietnam War. And his latest article at Spy Talk is Gaetz's Extortion Figures, Levinson's Obsession. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Stein.
Nice to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And this is an amazing twist in this emerging scandal involving Matt Gaetz, who's considered the kind of Trumpiest of members of Congress. Trump has praised him on a number of occasions. Curiously, he was the only person in the Congress to vote against a sex trafficking ban, human trafficking ban, I should say, and which is a little bit ironic now that he's possibly facing sex trafficking charges. But you've had a lot of interactions with this character who's emerged in the scandal, apparently in an attempt to blackmail the father of Matt Gaetz, who's apparently wealthy, and he's a former Air Force intelligence officer, and along with what looks like a Florida real estate scammer, have apparently been trying to blackmail Gaetz's wealthy father to put up money to rescue a former FBI agent held in Iran since March of 2007, who is presumed dead, and all this in exchange for preventing Matt Gaetz's sex trafficking scandal from going public, which it now has. So where to begin, Jeff?
Well, you know, I don't agree with this characterization of what this former Air Force intelligence officer who was trying to find the FBI agent, Bob Levinson, in Iran. I don't think it was an extortion or blackmail attempt as it's been described. I think it was more of a very clumsy enticement to Bob, to Matt Gaetz's father, a wealthy businessman in Florida, an enticement, however clumsy, to get him to loan, quote unquote, him $25 million to fund a mission to rescue Bob Levinson from Iran. I've spent hours talking to Bob Kent, this former Air Force intelligence officer. And I think he's just a man obsessed with the case of Bob Levinson, who everyone involved in this case is pretty sure he's dead and has been dead for some time now. He had a lot of health problems before he was captured on Kish Island, an Iranian island in the Persian Gulf. And a former senior intelligence official I was discussing this with this morning likened Bob Kent and others that I described in my Newsweek article 3 years ago, who were trying to get to locate Bob Levinson and rescue him. He compared it to the POW MIA issue of many years, in which during the 80s and 90s, it was very intense. It was a movement that was sure that POWs had been left behind in Vietnam. There was no evidence that that had occurred, but it's been a very powerful movement in American politics, mostly from the right, almost entirely from the right, for a long, long time. I don't think these private individuals who I described in my Newsweek piece are ideologically minded, although they have, you know, hostility toward Iran, but they're not politicos. They're just private individuals who are obsessed with getting Levinson back. And one of them, this guy, Bob Kent, the former Air Force intelligence officer, dreamed up this scheme to go when he read about Matt Gaetz's problem with a 17-year-old girlfriend and perhaps other young women that he was associated with. When he read about that, he said, wow, I can go to Gaetz's father, a very wealthy guy, and offer him a plan to finance Levinson's return, and we can get his son, the congressman, involved in it, and give him a lot of credit when the rescue is publicized. Now, that's about as wacky a scheme as you could come up with. But I think it was more of a very clumsy, wild-minded enticement rather than a shakedown. But I have to say that the emails or the messages that transpired between Kent and the congressman's father do smack of extortion. They were published by the Washington Examiner newspaper yesterday, a conservative outlet here in D.C., and they look entirely authentic. And it does sound like a shakedown, but I just think in Bob Kent's, I'm not being an apologist for him in any way, but I spent a lot of time talking to him, and I think it was just a very clumsy, excited scheme to entice the congressman's father into bankrolling this crazy, wild, not well-founded scheme to locate and rescue Levinson. So that's my take on it, anyway.
But surely, Jeff Stein, the key question is, how did Bob Kent find out about the fact that the Department of Justice had begun a probe into the congressman along with this other character, Joel Greenberg, down there in Florida. And this was an investigation signed off by Bill Barr when he was still in the Justice Department. So how would these characters have found out about this secret investigation that has now gone public, at least not the details in the investigation, but the fact that there is an investigation went public in a recent New York Times article?
Well, maybe you can refresh my memory. The Gates end of it isn't something that I've investigated, but what you're suggesting is that Bob Kent knew about the FBI investigation before it was made public by the New York Times. Is that what you're saying?
Well, apparently, didn't the stuff that the Washington Examiner print and I think even the New York Times article may have mentioned, that the meetings that took place between Gates' father and Bob Kent were back in March, were they not?
Yeah, March 17th, 18th.
Right. Well, that's well before the story broke.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how he knew about it. I contacted Bob Kent yesterday, and he wouldn't talk for the record about this case. And that's just a very good question to answer. I do know that Bob Kent has kept up his FBI contacts because he does have business. He does threat intelligence for oil companies and others in the Middle East, in particular Iraq. And as part of that work, you know, he tracks known terrorists and terrorist groups. And the FBI approached him about Levinson in late 2017, early 2018, and asked him in general way what he knew about, had he heard anything about Levinson. So they enlisted him, or maybe they didn't enlist him, they just asked him, had he heard anything? And that piqued his interest in Levinson. And he began to drill down then. And I saw lots of email traffic between Kent and other private individuals involved in rescue plans for Levinson. The FBI was very much interested in what they were doing. So it's quite possible that Kent learned this from his FBI contacts.
Well, of course, Bobby Levinson was a very, very skilled FBI counterintelligence agent specializing in Russian organized crime in New York. And he was one of the first to warn the FBI about the unholy alliance between Soviet intelligence and organized crime in Brighton Beach with the emigres that the Russian or the Soviets dumped on the United States through the Free Soviet Jewry Program. And he wasn't really listened to. Then he left the FBI and ended up involved in a cigarette smuggling case on Kish Island, where the Iranian Revolutionary Guards arrested him and he subsequently disappeared. And I imagine the FBI, who recently, well, back a couple of years ago, were talking to Bob Kent, was before they made the decision to announce to the family and to the public that they considered him dead, because the last proof of life was what, back in 2010, I think. So
yeah.
Does that explain sufficiently who Bob Levinson is? And it doesn't explain Bob Kent's obsession about him, does it?
No, I don't think there's any connection there that I see. The Levinson case has been raked over pretty thoroughly, including in a very good book by Barry Meyer of the New York Times. And Russian mobsters were also involved in coming forward and offering money to find Levinson and rescue him. It's a very tangled weave. But, you know, he had health medical problems that probably doomed him in captivity. And, I mean, he'd be 67, 68, I think, now, if he were still alive. In any event, quite a few years ago, intelligence sources were telling me that their private conclusion was that Levinson was dead. And Bob Kent knew this, but He didn't believe it. And he had sources feeding him information from inside Iran telling him that Levinson was alive. I happened to look at some of the those communications from Iran and documents that were given to him and other private parties trying to locate and rescue Levinson. A number of them were fabrications. Others were real, but you couldn't guarantee the provenance of them. You know, it's just, all of this is just kind of wacky. And it ends up almost as, you know, a black comedy involving Matt Gaetz and his father. It's a very bizarre story.
Well, there's another character, of course, that we have to include in here, and that is the lawyer who Matt Gaetz named on his somewhat disastrous interview with Tucker Carlson on Fox, McGee.
I think that's part of Bob Kent's initiative. I have not talked to David McGee about this latest issue, but I've dealt with David McGee a lot, and he is a straight shooter. And as you saw in my piece at Spy Talk, I have to put a plug in, spytalk.co, open for subscriptions, his reputation is very, very good. And having said that, he was also convinced that for many years, up until at least 2018 through 18, when I wrote my piece, and I think beyond, that Levinson was alive, and he was in constant contact with and pushing the FBI and Justice Department to be more aggressive about it. But the idea that he would be involved in an extortion scheme, I find that very doubtful. He's a straight shooting former federal prosecutor. And I think, again, this was in the idea that $250,000 should be deposited in David's law firm's account. I think this, again, sprung from the mind of Bob Kent. David McGee has vehemently denied any knowledge of this or involvement in that. And I'm frankly going to take him at his word. And my judgment, it's just a judgment, is that this all was part of Bob Kent's fevered imagination.
Well, David McGee thinks that the reason that Matt Gaetz blurted all this stuff out in that bizarre interview he did with Tucker Carlson on Fox News, where he named David McGee. McGee may actually sue Matt Gaetz for libel, but basically McGee, his only response so far has been in the Daily Beast, where he said any claims that he or his law firm were involved in extortion are completely, totally false. This is a blatant attempt to distract from the fact that Matt Gaetz is apparently about to be indicted for sex trafficking underage girls. So that's
that's true. I think Matt Gaetz did use it as a diversion. But the fact is that Bob Kent proposed that this money be deposited in McGee's law firm's account. That in no way can be taken as fact that McGee knew anything about it. I'm going to make my preliminary judgment that this, again, was an idea that sprung from Bob Kent's fevered imagination for this grand scheme to get Gates's father to bankroll this weird rescue attempt and put a laurel of flowers upon his son's head for being somehow involved. I think this is all Bob Kent's idea, and I highly doubt that McGee would have had any advanced knowledge of this money, this proposed money transaction.
Well, just in closing, Jeff Stein, is there a coincidence here that the so-called extortion that Matt Gaetz is claiming that Bob Kent was engaged in with his father for $25 million, isn't that the same amount that the reward was put up for information or the rescue of Bobby Levinson?
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting coincidence, isn't it?
So where do you think, just in closing, where do you think this is heading? Apart from the fact that, according to David McGee, he thinks that Matt Gaetz is about to be indicted for child sex trafficking.
Well, Matt Gaetz has some splaining to do, as they say. I'll leave it at that.
All righty. Well, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it, Jeff.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Stein, who's the editor and founder of Spy Talk and a deputy foreign news editor at the United Press International, a veteran national security reporter previously with Newsweek and The Washington Post. He specializes in U.S. intelligence, defense, and foreign policy, and is the author of A Murder in Wartime, the untold spy story that changed the course of the Vietnam War. And his latest article at Spy Talk is Gates Extortion Figures Levinson Obsession. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the convictions of prominent pro-democracy activists today in Hong Kong, with the billionaire publisher Jimmy Lai facing the prospects of life in prison for sedition under China's new national security law.
I'm a spy in the house of love. I know the dream that you're dreaming of. I know the word that
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Davis, a professor emeritus of law at the University of Hong Kong and previously a professor of human rights law at Northwestern University Law School. His books include Constitutional Confrontation in Hong Kong, Human Rights and Chinese Values, and International Intervention from Power Politics to Global Responsibility. And his latest book is Making Hong Kong China, The Rollback of Human Rights and the Rule of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Davis.
Thank you.
So, Michael Davis, you are familiar with these seven activists who've been found guilty for protests, and prominent among them, of course, is Jimmy Lai, who is a wealthy publisher of a tabloid that's very popular in Hong Kong, and he's been a thorn in the side of the Chinese authorities for some time, and he's a refugee from mainland China, but somebody that feels deeply and passionately about democracy. And some of the other characters as well, I believe the veteran politician Martin Lee is someone you know. Is that right?
We know him, all of these people, very well. They're old friends and people that we've had a lot of interactions with over the years.
We being you and your wife, Victoria Hui, right?
Yes.
So what do you think is their fate? I mean, he could be put away for life, couldn't he, under the sedition laws that Xi Jinping's just imposed on China, on Hong Kong?
Yeah, Jimmy Lai is in really serious situation because he's being charged on a number of fronts. The thing that's going on here, I think, is a kind of Beijing is settling some scores, I guess, with these more senior politicians who have participated in the process for many years, who have advocated nonviolence. Martin Lee has done that. In fact, all of them have practically. And they very well known in Hong Kong. And they weren't that active, actually, in the 2019 protest, which is kind of the target of Beijing's current attention. And yet there is this going after them that really sort of shows that this is a chance to settle old scores with people who have testified against China and so on in various parliaments around the world. And Jimmy Lai, certainly very much at the top of that list. Martin Lee is as well. He and Ho Chen Yen, Albert Ho, they were on a list of, you know, four people that Beijing was targeting as the Gang of Four a year or so ago. And so it's clear that, you know, these people are in Beijing's sights.
And Jimmy Lai's popular newspaper, Apple Daily, which is a tabloid, are they trying to shut that down, the Chinese authorities?
Well, I don't know if they'll succeed because it's a separate entity, but they after they arrested Jimmy Lai late last year, they sent over 200 policemen to, you know, cart away, I heard was about 15 boxes of papers and things from this newspaper's editorial room and its management offices. And so they were really going on a fishing expedition to find out what they could on him. Now, his case he was one of the seven in today's case where they were found guilty of unauthorized assembly. But in fact, Jimmy Lai has a separate case under the national security law, as you point out. And while unauthorized assembly can get a maximum of 5 years punishment, but probably unlikely that much, especially if it's their first conviction, the national security law allows punishment of 3 years to life. And Jimmy Lai tried to go out on bail for it under those charges. And the high court granted him bail under very strict conditions. And yet the government appealed it to the Court of Final Appeal and his bail was withdrawn. But what was interesting, while that appeal was pending, the People's Daily had an article where, in effect, they threatened that they were going to move him to the mainland and have him tried there if they didn't get what they wanted out of the Court of Final Appeal. This kind of pressure on the courts. And I think this is very representative of the kind of pressure that has been put on the rule of law in Hong Kong. Now, these cases involving these seven, why is the government even prosecuting these very moderate pan-democrats who ran a political party, held office, and so on in Hong Kong? And again, I think it's the same thing that's being targeted at Jimmy Lai, especially for Martin Lee, that Beijing considers him an old enemy.
Well, this is what the government of Xi Jinping, the Communist Party of China, is all about. I mean, one of the princelings who's now in exile, she refers to the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China as a mafia. I mean, they're acting like thugs. I mean, this is the message, right? We control the narrative and don't promote democracy. Autocracy is our model, and we're a lot... I mean, Xi Jinping is making it clear, apparently, in conversations with Joe Biden. He had a two-hour conversation with Biden recently. They know each other, and he makes no bones about the fact that he sees, and so does Putin, autocracy as the model of the future and democracy as a kind of flawed mess. So there's a lot at stake here, isn't there, in a broader context?
Yeah, I think the link you're drawing is an important one because, as Biden himself was saying in his speeches, and she likes to say as well, there's a kind of global competition between autocracy and democracy. China tried to use not its initial problems with COVID, but its later ability to have less infection as an example that, you know, their system works better at getting whatever they need to get done. So, you know, up until now, Hong Kong has been this bastion of a kind of liberal society, if not a full democracy, at least a very liberal human rights, open society. China was able to tolerate this because it wanted to be a part of the world, you know, to be welcomed in capitals of the world. But now it seems like it doesn't care. It kind of thumbs its nose at that. So in this global competition, I guess it wants to take one of the players off the table, and that's Hong Kong.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Davis, a professor emeritus of law at the University of Hong Kong and previously a professor of human rights law at Northwestern University Law School. His books include Constitutional Confrontations in Hong Kong, Human Rights and Chinese Values, and International Intervention from Power Politics to Global Responsibility. And his latest book is Making Hong Kong China, The Rollback of Human Rights and the Rule of Law. So it does seem pretty grim, the fate of Jimmy Lai, because I think Xi Jinping obviously wants to teach him a lesson, teach anybody a lesson, because he's the boss. You know, he's Uncle Xi. He's in charge. But in the mainland, isn't it fairly pervasive that the Chinese Communist Party's propaganda is really working on the people? Ever since Tiananmen, they've encouraged nationalism and materialism, and that, I guess, all of those demonstrations of these young Hong Kong activists have been portrayed in the mainland media, the state-controlled media, as being nothing but chaos. And that's what happened, by the way, in Russia. They were able to equate freedom with chaos, you know, during the Yeltsin period, and bring back autocracy. So is that what's going on here?
Well, it's certainly under Xi. There's been this, he seems that his target is to maintain Communist Party rule at all costs. So it's not just about whether China grows economically or the life of the people improves, but that Communist Party remains in charge. And I think the propaganda mission is to convince the people. And they're trying now to introduce that to Hong Kong in changing the educational system and so on, to convince the people that they do the job better. And when it comes to the mainland, because the media is controlled, well, we hear a lot of reports and we really don't know how to evaluate them, because doing an opinion poll in a closed society doesn't really tell you a lot. We don't know, but a lot of people presumably are pleased that Hong Kong is being put in its place. I don't know if that's the true story, if you could talk to people privately, but certainly that's the story that's being conveyed.
So does that make Jimmy Lai a minority, as a man who feels passionately about democracy?
Certainly not in Hong Kong, as we know. He's very much in the majority. And as the district council elections, the last ones that were held, which is the only level of government where there were full direct elections, the Democrats won. And so the people he supported won. The same with, Martin Lee was the founder of the Democratic Party. So in what China's trying to do in introducing the mainland kind of top-down system into Hong Kong is very much against what most Hong Kong people want. I mean, there's a kind of golden rule, they say, in Hong Kong, that 60% of the voters will support the opposition candidates and only 40% the government. So what's being done, and they've reformed the electoral system just this past week on Tuesday, they completely changed it. So that they guarantee, as someone once said, that China doesn't mind holding elections as long as it knows the outcome ahead of time. Well, that's pretty much now guaranteed in Hong Kong under these new election rules.
Right, and the new election rules are exactly the same as the election rules in Myanmar, where the military assign themselves a majority of seats. So, but my understanding is that China's dealings with Hong Kong was supposed to be a kind of precursor to their dealings with Taiwan. And the fact that it's all blown up and turned into basically a political takeover of Chinese authoritarianism and the squelching of democracy, how does this relate to now Taiwan, where the Chinese military have been very active in overflights over Taiwan, and there's some fears that there may be some military action in the future?
Yeah, I think that's kind of where we've gone. It used to be carrots and now it's sticks. China thought it would offer this one country, two system model that applied to Hong Kong with some further sweeteners, and that Taiwan people would go for it, but they never did. Yeah, I mean, it's not that they just stopped going for it. They never have been interested in it. They have never trusted the mainland government in that regard. And of course, what's happening to Hong Kong proves that maybe their judgment was correct. So that's sort of where it's at. And then, well, if we can't do it by carrots, can we do it by sticks? Can we use military force? And there's some kind of hints of that. And as you said, we don't know whether China will go that far, whether it's confident that it could pull it off. We, of course, a big question that would determine the outcome is what the United States would do. That's sort of on the table right now. There's missiles, lots of them aimed at Taiwan. Where it's going to go, we're not sure at the moment.
And then just in the last couple of minutes, then, how do you see Hong Kong in, say, 5 or 10 years?
Well, right now it looks pretty gloomy. We don't know sometimes how sometimes things are unpredictable, okay? One of the things we're seeing in Myanmar is in the face of extreme repression, the people are still speaking up. Whether things will happen in a way that Hong Kong people speak up again, they've done it repeatedly. That's one thing we don't know the answer to. The other thing we don't know the answer to is just how long Xi Jinping is going to persist and how long this sort of anti-reformist leadership in China will persist. And then finally, we don't know how well international community will push back against China's initiatives that we see at present.
But what do you know about the reformist movement in China?
Well, right now it's very silent. And they, you know, Xi Jinping arrested all these human rights defenders and a few years ago, the so-called 709 incident. And they persist in making those arrests. So it's very hazardous to get involved in human rights promotion and so on in China today. The Xi Jinping era has been a very hardline period, very autocratic period. So we don't know. One of the questions I've asked sometimes when I've had a chance of mainlanders is whether they think behind all of this, even at the top leadership, whether there are still reformists. Well, the answer seems to be if there are, they're silent at the moment.
Well, just in closing, do you think that, remember going back to Tiananmen, the young students kept demonstrating because of the death of Hu Yaobang, who was a reformer, and Zhao Jing was the leader then. He was purged. Eventually, the authorities, the hardliners, just got frustrated with the students, and then they moved in brutally. And it's somewhat similar in Hong Kong in the sense that the demonstrations went on, and it looks as if Beijing lost its patience. Can you make a case? I'm not saying that pro-democracy activists shouldn't do what is needed to make a stand for democracy, but in terms of tactics, is there any sense that the students actually, in effect, forced Xi Jinping's hand?
Not now, I don't think, because right after Tiananmen, as you probably know, there was a lot of emphasis placed on kind of re-educating youth and using all kinds of brainwashing tactics and so on. So it's hard to know whether there's any kind of student population as there was in 1989, but it seems unlikely. And of course, that's why there's so much emphasis going on in Hong Kong now about changing the educational system. And there's been new regulations and so on to require students to be taught about national security and all of these things about the new laws, and certainly not taught in a critical way. So, at present, we don't see that. We don't see any kind of underground movement to bring about reform or change. And we, as I mentioned a moment ago, we don't see much of that at the top either. So it's, it's a big country. Maybe there are voices that will emerge eventually, but it's not evident at the present.
Well, Michael Davis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Davis, a professor emeritus of law at the University of Hong Kong, who was previously a professor of human rights law at Northwestern University Law School. His books include Constitutional Confrontation in Hong Kong, Human Rights and Chinese Values, and International Intervention from Power Politics to Global Responsibility. And his latest book is Making Hong Kong China, The Rollback of Human Rights and the Rule of Law. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with an historian about why Georgia's new voting law is called Jim Crow 2.0. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jason Morgan Ward, a professor of history at Emory University, where he teaches modern United States history. His books include Defending White Democracy, The Making of a Segregationist Movement, and the Remaking of Racial Politics, and Hanging Bridge, Racial Violence and America's Civil Rights Century. And he has an article at the New York Times, Georgia's voter law is called Jim Crow 2.0 for a reason. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jason Morgan Ward.
Thank you for having me.
So ever since the surprise upset election in Georgia, where the Democrats picked up two Senate seats on January the 5th, the very next day, January the 6th, the Capitol was stormed, and there have been since then 361 voter suppression bills have been introduced this year, according to the Brennan Center for Justice, 361 bills introduced in 47 states to make voting harder. So there does seem to be a connection, surely, to what happened in Georgia, with the next day the Capitol being stormed, and since then this plethora of voter suppression bills?
I would argue that there is a connection. And one of the things that I try to stress in the piece is that if you look at debates over voting rights, and if you look at disfranchisement and voter suppression strategies, there's both a cycle and a pattern, but then there's also a spectrum, a range of strategies and possibilities, ranging from political violence to seemingly more subtle and refined forms of, you know, legal and political maneuvering and legislating. And so the connection I make in the piece that I wrote is between the Capitol riots and the pretext they provide, both in terms of a rationale for revisiting voter laws, and also the political cover that it provides when you are the alternative to political violence.
And in your article in the New York Times, Georgia's voter law is called Jim Crow 2.0 for a reason. Republicans today know that blocking access to the ballot has always relied on legal maneuvering and political schemes. You begin the article by recounting that 75 years ago this July, a World War II veteran named Maceo Snipes reportedly became the first black man to cast a ballot in his rural Georgia county. The next day, a white man shot him in his front yard, and Mr. Snipes soon died from his wounds. First of all, what happened to the white man who shot Maceo Snipes?
What happened to most, you know, white men of his era who engaged in violent attacks on African Americans? Nothing. He was, you know, he did not face any, you know, legal penalties or jail time for doing so. And the other part of that story is that he shot Maceo Snipes in the back, and Maceo Snipes was able, you know, made it to the local hospital alive, and he was denied a transfusion because the hospital said they had no black blood available. So he was denied a transfusion that could have prolonged or saved his life because they were still operating under a system of segregated blood banks. And this is also in the context of a very heated gubernatorial primary election. This was primary season. He had cast his vote in the Democratic primary. And the reason that he was certainly the first black man of his era to cast a ballot in his community was because the Supreme Court 2 years earlier, since the last election cycle, had declared the white primary unconstitutional. And so there was an opportunity for African Americans in Georgia and other states in midterm elections and in state elections to register and show up to vote in what had been blocked before. Access to the Democratic Party had been blocked before in many states, because they claimed that the Democratic Party was a private club and thus not subject to any kind of equal protection or non-discrimination statutes.
Well, as your article points out, and you mentioned the Supreme Court, our country has changed, said Chief Justice John Roberts in his 2013 decision in defending the Supreme Court's gutting of the key provision of the Voting Rights Act in Shelby County versus Holder. And clearly it has not, and clearly the minute that they struck out Section 5, all these states that had to pre-clear across the South and elsewhere in the country suddenly started introducing voter suppression laws. And now, of course, we're talking about an influx of 361 new voter suppression laws in 47 states following the Stop the Steal lie of Donald Trump to the moment, in just in this three-month period. So I'm reminded of the video image, as much as we were able to see, this secret signing of these laws by Governor Kemp standing in front of a picture of an antebellum plantation with a group of white men signing this bill in the kind of smug way, not in the violent way that Maceo Snipes was murdered. But they're murdering democracy, but they're doing it with a suit and tie.
Well, that's, I mean, even in the context of the 1946 primary season, I was fortunate that recently I had an undergraduate student who I cite in the article I wrote, who had actually done a deeper dive into a very extensive FBI investigation and FBI file that exists on the 1946 primary campaign. And nationally at the time, and certainly even in historical scholarship, we remember the 1946 primary campaign, both in Georgia and also in Mississippi, where there was a very diehard white supremacist senator who was running for re-election in the Democratic primary. And we remember both of these men, you know, Theodore Bilbo and then Eugene Talmadge in Georgia, for being outspoken white supremacists and deemed, you know, diehards even in their day. And we remember the violence, and we remember that they endorsed violence from the stump. We remember that people went out and committed violence in the name of voter suppression and intimidation. But what these FBI files reveal is that they're particularly interested and document extensively that even in this more violent political situation, the Talmadge supporters are cooking up various schemes from registration purges in local, you know, local registrars who are purging rolls. And also the system of challenge forms. So, you know, Eugene Talmadge had been governor previously, two terms, and he was barred from running for a third term. So he had set out for 2 years. Georgia had elected a relatively progressive governor, and Talmadge was storming back. So he was not actually in any kind of legal or administrative authority to enact voter restrictions. But he had these connections and this powerful, you know, political machine he had built, and they were engaging in all kinds of suppressive activities, most of which involved paperwork, right? They were either purging, you know, his local cronies in courthouses around the state were purging African Americans who had recently registered or coming up with pretext for disqualifying them, or everyday citizens were, you know, being handed these, you know, white people were being handed these pieces of paper that they could use to personally challenge, directly challenge and nullify black votes in their communities. So, you know, the takeaway from that is that even in these times we remember for, you know, excessive political violence, the white supremacy campaigns of the 1890s, when Jim Crow laws are enacted and disfranchisement laws are enacted, state constitutions are rewritten, the Reconstruction era, following the Civil War, even in these eras that we remember for violence, a lot of this is paper pushing. A lot of this is about legislation and judicial maneuvering and scheming, right? Because if there's anything that the history of, you know, black politics has taught us in this country, it's that African Americans will defy the threats and the dangers put in front of them to cast ballots. And even the most virulent white supremacists in American history recognized that you couldn't kill them all and you couldn't scare them all off. And so even the most virulent white supremacists who relied on violence and stoked violence in their base also recognize that you have to do the legislation. You have to play, you know, play through the courts, and you have to come up with a plethora of strategies, a real web of strategies that can trap anyone who tries to get through them on their way to the ballot box, to the polls.
And again, I'm speaking with Jason Morgan Ward, a professor of history at Emory University, where he teaches modern United States history. His books include Defending White Democracy, The Making of a Segregationist Movement and the Remaking of Racial Politics, and Hanging Bridge, Racial Violence and America's Civil Rights Century. And he has an article at the New York Times, Georgia's Voter Law is Called Jim Crow 2.0 for a Reason. So, you know, I'm reminded when I was just listening to what you were just saying then, Jason, you know, that one of the many Jim Crow tricks, which were actually quite sadistic, really, when you think about it, and frankly, I still to this day cannot understand the mentality of white segregationists and supremacists. And after all, they kind of went under a rock for a while, but Donald Trump invited them back into the public sphere, and now they seem to, they certainly were among those that stormed the Capitol, and they seem to be in Trump's GOP, since now Trump dominates the GOP. But, you know, one of the tricks, for example, was counting the jelly beans in a jar. I mean, even if you got it right, for some reason or other, you actually got the right number, they would have turned around and said you failed, right?
Yes. I mean, I just mentioned this idea of a web. Right. That catches you. I mean, the other thing that the web does is it has holes that you can slide through. So one of the things that made disfranchisement law so durable was that the authors of these disfranchisement measures, which, you know, vary from state to state, they don't all adopt them at the same time. Mississippi, which I've also spent a lot of time researching about, writing about, and living in, it was one of the first. In 1890, they adopted a constitution that included literacy tests, what they called the Understanding Clause. And the literacy test and the Understanding Clause work together, much like your jelly bean example. Literacy test was used to disqualify African Americans who could not prove that they could read. They were given a passage, ostensibly, and if they couldn't read it, they failed. The Understanding Clause was a way around that requirement for whites who were also illiterate, and there were a lot of them in the South in that era. So if a white person came to register and couldn't read the passage, then the registrar could give them a pop quiz, presumably on the state constitution or on the passage that they were supposed to read, but really on anything they felt like. And so that was a way around the literacy requirement for illiterate whites. If you were literate and black, and could prove that you could read, the Understanding Clause was a way to disqualify you anyway, because they could ask you a pop quiz question about the passage or about anything else and then fail you, no matter what you said. So it gave a lot of power to local registrars, and they knew exactly how they were expected to wield that power and how these measures gave them the latitude to register those they wanted to register or disqualify those they wanted to disqualify. And in the Mississippi example, because they went first, they were one of the first states. Georgia did not come until later. But they cleared the way for Georgia because they're sued for passing these new measures and writing them into their constitution. And the case reaches the Supreme Court, and it's called Williams v. Mississippi. It was decided in 1898. And the Supreme Court refused to intervene. They were being asked to intervene on the grounds that this violated the 14th Amendment provision for equal protection under the law. And that in explaining why they couldn't intervene, they pointed out that, you know, the literacy test and the Understanding Clause don't mention race. Right. and they also said this. They said it has not been shown that the actual administration of these measures was evil, but only that evil was possible under them. And so that's the bind and the challenge that you're put in challenging these statutes that are, you know, literally non-racial or non-discriminatory, because they put the burden of proof on the appellant, on the plaintiff to prove what is sometimes unprovable, right? The intent and practice of these laws and these measures. Like, the intent can be racial. The governor, you know, one of the lead hardcore white supremacists in Mississippi at the time of the Constitutional Convention said and was quoted as saying the purpose of these laws is to keep blacks out of politics. It didn't matter that he said it. It mattered that they didn't write that into the Constitution. There was nowhere in the Mississippi State Constitution of 1890 that says black people are not allowed to vote. But right. if you combine the literacy test, the understanding clause, the grandfather clause, which is also, you know, non-racial, but very clearly, you know, racial in its day, the idea that if your grandfather could vote, you know, pre Civil War, you were exempted from these other qualifications.
Right. But isn't that pretty much what Governor Kemp of Georgia is now saying today about criticism of the laws that he just passed? Oh, you know, there's nothing to it. There's no racism. I'm not a racist. You know, Stacey Abrams is calling it Jim Crow 2.0. How dare she? I mean, it gets back to my puzzlement about why are these white men so mean and nasty? What is it about this effort to turn back the clock? There must be some deep insecurity there.
Well, I don't, you know, I wouldn't argue that history, you know, repeats itself, which I say in this piece, but I'm quick to remind anyone who reads anything I write that my argument is not that history simply repeats itself or moves in any kind of predictable or discernible cycle, but that you have to hear the echoes, right? And you have to see the patterns when they emerge. And, you know, there's a lot about this that is intentionally not nasty, at least on its face, right? And that, you know, American society and, you know, certainly their particular political arguments, you saw this in Chief Justice Roberts' statement and justification in 2013 in Shelby v. Holder, America has changed. It's very hard to break out of a progressive narrative that presumes from generation to generation, everything gets more refined and subtle and civilized. And, you know, part of refuting that assumption and refuting that narrative is not simply to say that the capacity for violence, the capacity for upheaval, the capacity for nastiness is still there. It's also to point out that the other half has always been there. Right. Because this is not about progressive refinement of strategy or even progressive refinement of belief, not just because the violence is still present, but also because the subtlety is still present. It was present in the 1890s. It was present in the Civil War era. You know, people still really like to argue that the South, you know, did not fight the Civil War over slavery. Part of the reason that they continue to do that is because there were Southerners at the time who had a PR team. Like, they knew that that was a bad look, and they had a sense that they didn't want to go down in history as the folks, you know, who went down fighting for chattel slavery. And so, you know, they were doing legacy maintenance, and they were creating a counter narrative even at the time. So I think both halves are important. It's not just that people are still capable of great nastiness and evil. It's that people have also always been capable of reflection and strategy.
Whitewashing history.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, Jason Morgan Ward, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jason Morgan Ward, a professor of history at Emory University, where he teaches modern United States history. His books include Defending White Democracy, The Making of a Segregationist Movement and the Remaking of Racial Politics, and Hanging Bridge, Racial Violence in American Civil Rights and America's Civil Rights Century. And he has an article of the New York Times, Georgia's Voter Law is Called Jim Crow 2.0 for a Reason. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.